Welcome to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore people, stories, and events in Central Iowa. I'm Gail Seiler, and I'm here with my co-host, Ursula Rudenberg. Hello, Ursula.
Hello, Gail, and hello. Thanks for joining us. Our first day of our fourth year of KHOI.
Right, that's a good way to think about it. Moving forward. And hello to you, the listener.
Hello, thanks for joining us. Today is the first day of school, and so we wish our engineer, Jonah DeGeest, a good first day of school.
If you've been listening to KHOI over the past few weeks, you probably know that we are celebrating KHOI's birthday this month. And Sunday, yesterday, was our big birthday celebration, and it was quite a day. In the afternoon, we had the opportunity to hear a talk by Nicholas Johnson, former Federal Communication Commissioner, and he spoke on the origin and future of radio. And I would say that his talk was enlightening and a bit humorous.
Mr. Johnson is more than 80 years old and has had a full career, and he was remarkably energetic and a powerful man, very tall for one thing. The first thing he did was throw up his hands and say how remarkable it was that we had survived for 3 years. It was really very uplifting when he did that.
In many ways, paid a lot of respect to KHOI and acknowledged what has been accomplished in not just 3 years, more than 3 years, because there was so much preparation, as everyone has been hearing about as we recount our history. And of course,
it was great to have him.
Yeah, it was. It was a good day. And so we're going to relive a little bit of that for the listener this morning. Of course, we recorded the speech, and we're going to play a couple highlights from it now. First, we want to play Veronica Fowler, who introduced Mr. Johnson. She's been a reporter in Des Moines and in Ames and is now the public relations person for the ACLU in Iowa. In her introduction, Ms. Fowler had some really interesting things to say about the former commissioner, so we're going to play a bit of that.
I'm very, very pleased to have the privilege of introducing Mr. Johnson. Mr. Johnson is now at the University of Iowa College of Law, but he's perhaps best known as being a former commissioner of the Federal Communications Commission, the FCC, from 1966 to 1973, which, as you know, we had President Nixon as our administration leader at that time, so that had to be fairly interesting. He has been, for decades, a leader in the media reform movement, and his rallying cry has been, whatever your first priority is, everyone's second priority should be media reform. So keep that in mind as he inspires us today. It's appropriate that at this anniversary celebration, he's going to be talking about the origins and the future of radio. In discussing the role of community media in today's ever-changing communications landscape, he brings a longtime insider's insights on national policy and decision-making from the perspective of a long and distinguished career in the national conversation about media. He was FCC commissioner for 7 years. It was often tumultuous, and he was anything but a rubber-stamping bureaucrat. He was a rabble-rouser who affected a lot of some of the changes that we see in media today. Some of the progress that's been made with public television, more responsible programming, and many other things. And if you need proof of the sort of maverick FCC commissioner that he was, he is the only FCC commissioner ever featured on the cover of Rolling Stone. In 1970, he wrote the book, How to Talk Back to Your Television Set, which became something of a Bible for the media reform movement. Really the sort of opening rounds of that conversation in a very national way. It presented prototypes for things like community media, of course, which KHOI would be part of, and advocated for community voice and influence in mass media. He is an Iowa native. He was born in Iowa City and raised in Iowa, and he returned here in 1980. He now teaches at the University of Iowa College of Law, and his emphasis is on communications and internet law. He is an active blogger, and he has posted more than 1,000 essays since 2006, and he continues to advocate for the reform of mass media. And I didn't ask him if he has a Twitter account, but if he does, he does. And so I hope you share that with us all. So thank you so much, Mr. Johnson.
We called Mr. Johnson last week here on Local Talk prior to the event because we wanted to give a little bit of a sense of who this person was. When he was on the phone with us, he described what an FCC commissioner does and some of the things that he did while he was a commissioner and while he was working in Washington, D.C. So we're going to hear some of that conversation now.
The Federal Communications Commission is what's called an independent regulatory commission. That is to say, it's not a part of the executive branch of the government.
Right.
The president appoints the commissioners, and the Senate confirms them just as if they were executive branch appointees. But while they are usually appointed for a term, and during that term they cannot be removed. As a result of my positions, Richard Nixon sought to have me impeached, and I discovered that there were no procedures for impeaching FCC commissioners, and then, as you may recall, subsequently discovered that there were procedures for impeaching presidents.
Why did Richard Nixon want to impeach you?
I was questioning some of the things that the administration was doing, and I wrote a big full-page piece in the New York Times reciting some of the lyrics. He had the U.S. Army put together for him a multimedia show regarding some of these lyrics. And so I questioned how war, what's it good for, absolutely nothing, as a lyric, should be criminally punished for somehow encouraging drug addiction and so forth. I challenged other things. I found in the Rise and Fall of the Third Reich an explanation of Hitler's approach to political rallies and so forth, and then published that in parallel columns with what the Nixon administration was doing at public rallies, and noted that there seemed to be they almost seemed to have plagiarized from the man. Well, needless to say, things like that, and I was throwing something at him probably a couple times a month, and ultimately it kind of gets under their skin, you can imagine.
Is this how you ended up on the cover of Rolling Stone magazine?
I suspect it had something to do with it. He had a broader vision for the publication than merely the music biz. They were talking about what I was doing on the FCC generally. In addition to being a media critic, I've also worked in the media. I hosted a show that was carried by PBS stations back in the sort of early to mid-80s called New Tech Times, which is usual for me, was about 20 years ahead of its time. I think it would have done much better in the 90s than it did in the early 80s. And I was doing regular commentaries on National Public Radio. I covered Rag Brave for NPR in the early days. And while I was doing that and a national public lecturing business through the Lee Lecture Bureau in New York, I was also writing a nationally syndicated column for which I gave the title Communications Watch.
Wow. And then you were also working with Jimmy Carter as well as an advisor, is that correct?
I've been involved in the Carter Center, at which he also participated and worked a number of countries around the world trying to lend them a hand on dealing with their own media policy issues.
In his speech in Ames yesterday, Mr. Johnson took an historical perspective. He made the point that radio in the early years was more like community radio today. Let's pick up his talk as he was discussing that period.
At that time, the amateurs had some 8,500 licenses, and by 1927, there were over 700 radio stations broadcasting programming, many of which had been initially developed by amateurs but might be owned by others in 1927. But less than 100 of them had network affiliation. So at that time, what we had as radio is very similar to what you are doing with your station. These were relatively low-power stations in relatively small towns, much smaller than Ames is now, that were of necessity putting out local programming because there wasn't anything else. But they were also mindful of the purpose that that served and why that was desirable. So those are some of your station's ancestors, those early 8,500 amateur radio stations those 700-plus broadcasting stations putting out programming and music and speech and so forth. Note that the industry wanted Herbert Hoover to abolish those low-power stations, and he refused to do it. So that's something you owe Herbert Hoover, if nothing else, but you owe him other things as well, actually. But he limited them all to one frequency, 833 kilohertz, about where KXIC is in Iowa City. In the years from 1923 to 1927, there were some 31 bills introduced in the House for regulating these new stations that were dealing with programming. And by 1927, according to the great radio historian Eric Barnow, the demand for legislation was shrill. And now here comes a truly remarkable story based on what we're used to from the U.S. House of Representatives over the last few years. This shrill demand came in November and December of 1926. By February of 1927, the 1927 Radio Act had been passed through Congress, signed, and was law 2 months. And bear in mind what you had going on at that time in terms of competition, which I'll come to in a moment. It turned out that after the Big Four, RCA, GE, Westinghouse, and AT&T got together and created an RCA with NBC Network, which had two networks, actually, the Red Network and the Blue Network, that this regulatory, which happened about the same time as the Act was passed, sadly, and the Act, which was really more addressed to mom-and-pop low-power stations in small rural communities, was no longer really well-suited to hold the forces of big business conglomerates, networks, the domination by advertisers, and so forth, what I, in an article in The Atlantic in 1968, referred to as the media barons. But even though the miracle of radio was only barely understood in 1926, there was an awareness of the risk of monopoly power and ownership. And one member of the House from Texas, Luther Johnson, no relative of mine or of Lyndon's, said, "American thought and American politics will be largely at the mercy of those who operate these stations." American thought and politics. "For publicity is the most powerful weapon that can be wielded in a republic. And when such a weapon is placed in the hands of one or a single selfish group is permitted to either tacitly or otherwise acquire ownership and dominate these broadcasting stations throughout the country, then woe be to those who dare to differ with them." Woe be to those who dare to differ with them. How prescient can you be? He concludes, "It will be impossible to compete with them in reaching the ears of the American people." Secretary Hoover said, "It would be most unfortunate if broadcasting should be controlled by any corporation, individual, or combination." And 30 years later, in 1956, Senate Commerce Committee Chairman Warren Magnuson was still warning the commission that it, quote, "should be on guard against the intrusion of big business and absentee ownership." So we've been dealing with that for a long time, but we've still maintained at least some of these local stations, both commercial and non-commercial like yours.
This is Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, and we're listening to excerpts from a talk that was given yesterday by Nicholas Johnson, a former FCC commissioner that was part of KHOI's celebration. Mr. Johnson mentioned in the speech, made reference to the Congress today can't act as quickly as it did in those days. I think in many ways one can apply that to today's Federal Communications Commission too. Mr. Johnson is really cut out of a different ilk from the kind of people today managing the airwaves at the Washington, D.C. level. And
I think Iowa can really be proud that we produced a commissioner that was such an independent thinker and that really went into his job in Washington, D.C. with really the highest integrity and with a great interest in the public good. And that's really, in a way, what he's talking about in his talk here, too, is how radio can serve the public good and how KHOI serves the public good. I'm very proud that our commissioner from Iowa went to D.C. and conducted himself in such a courageous and thoughtful way.
During his tenure, he was drawing more attention to the issues around media conglomeration and really the role of the media and the role of the radio. And now the FCC has kind of faded into the background because it seems like the members don't really take the kinds of stands that he took.
Right. Well, they serve a different master these days.
Yeah.
We just heard Mr. Johnson talk about the early days of radio. And later in his speech, he explained about what has happened in more recent years. He explained how many of the goals of radios in terms of responsibility to the community have been undermined by deregulation.
Now, at my time, which was 1966 to 73, station licenses were still limited to three-year terms. We had very strict limits on how many stations anybody could own, AM and FM and TV. Renewals required the presentation of a log of all the programming for what we called a composite week. It was days selected at random from the past term. They had to report quantities of commercials, number of PSAs, public service announcements, and percentages of programming devoted to news, devoted to public affairs, and what we called programming other than entertainment programming. There were some rays of hope. There were license renewal challenges. There was the beginnings of a media reform movement. And various groups, the women's movement, the African-American movement at the time, took an interest in what you've been told. I once titled a book, Your Second Priority, that whatever else they're trying to accomplish, I told them, you gotta work on media reform or you don't have a prayer of accomplishing anything. And if you do work on media reform, you at least have a chance. And so that was good. But with the 1980s came Ronald Reagan's mantra, government is not the solution, government is the problem. At the FCC, as with many other agencies of government, this took the form of what they called deregulation. So pushing aside the former concern with monopoly control of media power, Congress changed the law in 1996 from a limitation of a handful of radio stations to a standard that permitted Clear Channel ultimately to own 1,225 radio stations in 300 cities and to have the largest audience share in 100 of 112 major markets. Some of us asked the CEO of one of the companies desiring to merge with others, why are you guys doing this? You know, you're making over 100% return on depreciated capital now. How much wealthier do you need to be? What's your motive? What are you trying to accomplish? And he replied very candidly. He said, listen, someday there are going to be five firms that control all the media on planet Earth. And we intend to be one of them. Pretty straightforward, right? And it's come closer and closer, obviously, to that.
That was former FCC member Nicholas Johnson, who spoke yesterday as part of KHOI's birthday celebration. After the talk by Nicholas Johnson, we all went over to Bar La Tosca in Ames, where everyone seemed to have a really good time. The food was delicious, the music by Calle Sur was wonderful, and there was just a feeling of community and celebration and recognition.
Yeah, thank you so much to John Reed and his whole staff at Bar La Tosca. They were wonderful hosts, and Calle Sur was great. There was dancing by the end of the night, and it was just a really, really nice evening.
Yeah, and the weather was lovely, and people just kind of spilled out onto the sidewalk when they wanted a little fresh air. So a good time to bring people together, and we look forward to birthday 4.
Yeah, and if you joined us yesterday, thank you for coming out and helping us celebrate, and thank you to those of you who made a donation to KHOI. That's very helpful to us, too.
And if you want to continue to make a donation.
We need the money.
Yes. We'd better stop talking about the birthday party and birthday events. We have some other stories we want to share with our listener today. So let's get to those.
Okay.
Each month, KHOI brings you a community appreciation segment. This month, we're featuring an organization called Legacy Learning. They are a nonprofit organization in Webster City, which offers hands-on workshops and classes that foster appreciation of natural resources through art and nature studies, and they're taught by artists, environmentalists, and craftspeople. This whole organization is based on the idea of a staycation, where you go somewhere and you live there and stay there, as well as take part in the workshops. It's an economic development project that was initiated to support the beauty and natural resources of the Boone River Valley. So KHOI reporter Kay Puddock interviewed Maureen Simmons, a board member of Legacy Learning. And we're going to hear her interview now. Maureen begins by talking about why this organization came into being.
Webster City was hard hit by the loss of a major factory a couple of years ago, and a group of us were talking one evening, and we thought it would be great to organize a new development concept of economic development for Webster City around what we already have there that can't move, and that's our natural resources. We wanted to make sure that we were inclusive of not just the county, but the whole Boone River Valley. We're really lucky to live in the Boone River Valley because of the beauty and the uniqueness of it.
So you're situated mostly in Webster City, and you give classes?
We do.
So people come and stay in cabins and so on for the...
Some stay in motels, a few stay in cabins to be with family. And we use the venues throughout the county, mostly focusing on the parks and the natural resources.
Would you give us an idea of the kind of classes you teach?
People come together to learn something that's been maybe on their bucket list, but then they haven't had a chance to pursue that. We've taught many classes for many different ages.
Yeah, and I just want to read the classes that I've got on this little handout here. Prairie pottery, horsehair raku, wild edibles, photographic treasure hunt, tool making, stones in archaeology, leather making rawhide drums, watercolor pencils, and landscape with oils and acrylics. And then in August, welding garden sculptures, willow garden furniture, outdoor photography, jewelry making, and so on. And it goes on. That's just a few of them.
It does go on.
And most of your classes and workshops tie together nature and art.
Correct. That's part of our mission. Mm-hmm. That's true.
Yeah. Could you say a bit more about your mission?
We have really tried to create a staycation atmosphere.
Staycation, where people stay.
Where people stay and kind of a mini retreat. We also long for the idyllic, able to get away for 2 weeks and go to the wilderness and study something exotic. But in all practicality, if we can get away several hours or a couple days, that's our special ability. So we address that market.
So most of your workshops and classes are just 2 days, are they?
They vary from half days to 3 days.
Okay, so it's an intense short period.
But that's a good way of putting it. It is an intense short period, and our professionals come from all over the Midwest and are really renowned in their field. And so the workshops are just very dynamic, interesting occasions where you learn so much from your peers, and the people you work with are as important as the teacher who presents. And we really want to emphasize that it's not classes as much as it is workshops. It's very dynamic. It's very active, and people actually make things and take things home.
Right.
They accomplish things.
Right.
So.
They are intense events for a couple of days, right?
They are. They really are meant to be an experience where when you put people who really are either curious or already share a love of something, and then you put them with a really accomplished professional, you really have a dynamic environment for learning. We have plenty of time to relax. We have a noon hour where people can leave and go to the coffee shop or get together at the restaurant. And that's actually one of the times you really get to share conversation, because you get really involved in what you're making. Mm-hmm. And so it's really a nice time to be able to share with the rest of the class over a meal.
Let's talk a little bit about the upcoming, that Chautauqua
the
thing.
The Chautauqua thing.
Based on the idea of the Chautauqua, which was popular in the 19th century.
It was. And so it's an unfamiliar concept now, but we thought how fun to have that idea of being a learning community, where no matter what you wanted to learn about or be curious about or wonder about, you could come and maybe test the waters at a weekend in Webster City. We did a learning weekend last winter in the doldrums of late January, and we called it the Winter Getaway, and it was really successful. So we thought we would do a fall version of that, where we bring people in for an entire weekend. The event we'll have in October around the Chautauqua is really going to be a learning weekend where we bring in all sorts of musicians, speakers, workshop presenters, etc., and focus on classes that are for intergenerational classes. So, we actually say Chautauqua, and it's a U in every syllable, so that's a way to remember it.
Uh-huh. And, of course, in the 19th century, they didn't have TV or movies, and this was, people went to lectures and classes as a form of entertainment.
They did. It was actually quite a popular event for a while. We are going to have a variety of sessions. We'll have quilt making. We'll have basket making. We will have a pottery class. We're going to have an old car workshop where people can talk about how they got into that or what they'd like to share with newbies in that field. And we've encouraged businesses that have certain things in theirs. Stony Creek will offer a welding workshop again, and the SOS store has a leather maker that's resident there, and he will offer a workshop in his space. So throughout the community, there's going to be several events. There's also going to be a stress management, essential oils. There's going to be musicians, Flying Pig Studios, and band will be coming. They'll be giving both lessons and presenting a performance. We'll have Mike Zam is a children's storyteller, musician slash artist. That's a lot of fun. He'll be there. David Raven is a painter who's coming from the Twin Cities. He came last year, and it was a wonderful experience. We met in the park, and it was really, whether you were an accomplished painter or had much experience painting, or you'd painted for years and years, it was just a lovely, lovely weekend.
Now, you get a lot of support from the local community, I believe, that help you with this. You are a nonprofit, but you get a lot of help from...
We have. We've been very fortunate to have received our third local hotel motel grant, and that really shows that there's a lot of local support for it and that they appreciate the fact that it could be long-term economic development for our community.
And it brings people in.
Bring people in, and it really shares what we're already proud of and knowledgeable about with others. We really shared a love of both the arts and an appreciation of the beauty of our local environment, our natural resources. One of us is a retired natural resource professional that used to be head of forestry in Iowa. And he always had made the comment, as our community went through such pain with the loss of a major manufacturer that moved to Mexico, he always said, if we tied our economic development to natural resources, it is really part of the community forever.
Right.
It can do nothing but grow.
Mm-hmm.
It can't move. It can't be taken away. It is there for you forever. And he always had a real hope that we would understand someday as communities how important those natural resources were to our economic development as well as our spiritual.
Well, it sounds if there's a lot of really interesting stuff here, and as you say, in a beautiful part of the country, beautiful part of the state. I've been talking to Maureen Siemens of Legacy Learning. And again, the website is Legacy Learning BRV, standing for Boone River Valley, legacylearningbrv.org. And you can find the details of the classes there. And I'm Kay Partick. I've been talking to Maureen Siemens of Legacy Learning, Boone River Valley.
And that was Kay Patak with Community Appreciation segment for KHOI. Thank you, Kay. And this is KHOI Community Radio. We've been hearing a lot about the presidential candidates appearing at the state fair and all across Iowa. But that is not the only election that we should pay attention to. As they say, politics is local, and there are local elections for school board coming up in Ames. The actual election is on September 8th for the school board.
And we've been joined in the studio by members of the Ames Progressive Alliance, Ann Kinzel and Victoria Shapinski. Thanks for being here.
Thank you. Good morning.
Ames Progressive Alliance is sponsoring a forum for the school board candidates, and they came in to tell us about it. So let's start off by just telling us a little bit about what is Ames Progressive Alliance?
Sure. The Ames Progressive Alliance is a group of people who started coming together last spring. And over the summer, we held a picnic at Brookside Park, which attracted about over 300 people who were interested in, I think, our mission of leading Ames towards a more prosperous future by leveraging some community resources aimed at progressive priorities. And when we say progressive priorities, we're talking about social justice, alternative transportation, a new way of looking at our environmental resources, developing renewable energy, sustainable and, more importantly, even equitable economic development, and the empowerment of residents of our community.
Admirable goals.
Thank you.
And I would also add that we're a nonpartisan group, but we're open to anyone who would like to join us. We have a variety of committees who are doing things, but generally, if you identify yourself as a progressive, I would think this is the organization for you.
Okay, and you have gotten some good attendance at events so far.
Yep.
Give us some background on this school board election, if you would.
Okay. Well, in previous elections, sometimes we've not had more candidates than we have seats that are open, but fortunately this time we do have a race. There are five candidates for four open seats. Two of the candidates are incumbents, so we have three new people that are entering. And I can lead into how we are participating in this election, which I will add that local is important, that both school board, city council, and the board of supervisors, I would argue, play a bigger role in everyone's daily lives than what happens at a state or national level. Even those they tend to seem like they're more exciting.
Why do you say that?
Because, for example, what happens to your children every day, what they're learning, if they're being, what kind of activities they're involved in, if they're getting good nutrition, all those sorts of decisions are made by a school board. At the city level, we can spend a whole show talking about that, but, mm-hmm. We run our own water plant and power plant, and we make decisions about how much money goes to human services. So in some cases, it is a life and death decision-making that goes on at a city level.
It directly affects us.
But we can make changes. I mean, we talk about wanting to have alternative energy. As a citizen, you can play a much bigger role in having alternative energy sources, for example, actually happen through a city council than what it's going to take at a national level.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So I divert, but
but do you know what the issues are that are really at stake here with this election with these different candidates?
Oh, I think there are huge issues. There are issues that, having seen what happened with Breckenridge and the property of the old middle school, the school board is now in the land business. There are other properties, Edwards School, and which is currently being used as a location for Sawyer, but after this year is over and those students move back to Sawyer, that building will be on the docket to be sold. There's also Crawford School, which when it no longer is the administration building because of the new administration building being built on 24th Street, that's going to be a similar situation to what we were looking at before. And let's say, let's hope it's not a similar situation to what happened before, because we would like to see that neighbors have a larger role in determining what happens to those properties in their neighborhood. And we go – sorry.
So the handling of those property will be one of the questions discussed at the forum?
Definitely.
Mm-hmm. Any other issues?
I was just going to say that in earlier conversations – they mentioned that they have a rather unique way that they've been gathering ideas on what the issues are from from the public. So maybe you can tell us
we
that.
We have enlisted several progressive groups throughout the community to formulate questions that are specific to their concerns. So people who are involved in housing, people who are involved in nutritional interests, academic focus of particular groups. So, and then we will take also questions from the public, which we are gathering currently online.
So Victoria and I have sort of the fun but thankless sometimes task of, of organizing the forums and putting together all the volunteers to get done what we want to do. And we have a second group that focuses more on the political side of the questions and looks at how to run the forum itself. So we're fortunate that we have a large group of volunteers that are engaged in this.
And so tell us when and where the candidate forum is going to be.
Sure. It's going to be September 1st at the Ames Public Library. We are starting out with an ice cream social at 5:30 and then following up with a forum at 6:30. The library is co-sponsoring the forum with us, and we're putting on our own ice cream social. We also have childcare, and we think this is really, really exciting because, let's be honest, in Ames, a lot of local political activity involves, shall we say, people of a certain age. And we want to broaden that, especially for a school board race. We want to see families involved. And so by providing some child activities at the library, supervised activities for kids 4 and up, we hope to provide the opportunity for families to get more involved in the process than perhaps they have in the past in Ames. And it's our understanding this is the first time anybody's tried something like this.
It's very nice. What exactly is the ice cream social?
Well, we're just Hy-Vee very generously donated ice cream to us, and in front of the library, if the weather is good, we're going to be serving ice cream.
Well, that should draw people in.
Mm-hmm. And we'll move inside. We have a backup if the weather is also not good. And one thing I also wanted to add about young people is that there were a couple of young people who we had asked to join us this morning, but unfortunately, because of school starting, they were already booked.
And who's doing the child care?
Well, we're really lucky. We have that pre-kindergarten superstar, Ray Haas, is going to be helping with reading and activities and puppets and stuff, sing-alongs and stuff like that in one room for the 4 to 9-year-old set. And then we have movie. Now, what's the title of that movie?
Spirited Away.
That's it. In another room. So we're trying to cover all ages. When kids are under 9 in the library, they must be supervised. So we will be recording those kids, keeping them in the room with us, giving their parents an opportunity to participate in the political process.
Okay. Thank you so much. That's excellent. And why don't you give us again the exact time and place? And
It's Tuesday, which is September 1st, and that will be in the Farwell T. Brown Auditorium at the Ames Public Library. And we hope people will join us, and this will be a little bit different format, so something new to see also.
And this is a forum for the candidates for
the Ames School Board.
5:30 for ice
cream. But I also may – oh, sorry.
5:30 for ice cream, 6:30 for the politics.
Okay.
But we'll also be doing a forum for the city council candidates on October 29th, and that will follow a similar format.
Excellent.
So put that on your calendars, please.
Okay. Board of Education.
Yeah. Thank you very much for being here.
Thank you for joining us.
And I appreciate it.
We look forward to other events from Ames Progressive Alliance.
hasta el cielo en el mundo, por hondo que esté el mar profundo, no habrá una barrera en el mundo que un amor profundo no pueda romper. Amor es el pan de la vida, amor es la copa divina, amor es un algo sin nombre que obsesiona al hombre por una mujer. Yo estoy obsesionado contigo y el mundo es testigo de mi frenesí. Por más que se oponga el destino, serás para mí, para mí. Amor es el pan de la vida, amor es la copa divina, amor es un algo sin nombre que obsesiona al hombre por una mujer.
That was Calle Sur, the duo who played wonderful music yesterday at KHOI's birthday party at Bar La Tosca. Really was enjoyable and got people up and dancing. We just spoke with folks from the Ames Progressive Alliance talking about the school board elections. But so now we're going to move from local to national issues and really to address an issue that is coming more and more to the forefront, especially with Republicans right now, the issue of immigration. And there's an upcoming event called Unite Iowa on Immigration, which is being billed as a nonpartisan conversation on immigration in Iowa, and obviously very relevant to the upcoming presidential elections. The website says that Unite Iowa on Immigration is designed as a uniquely civil forum, and we aim to create an oasis of thoughtful dialogue in the middle of another presidential caucus cycle when the rhetoric tends to divide us. So we wish them luck with that. And we've been joined in the studio by Jan Flora, who will tell us more about this event. Thank you for joining us, Jan.
Yeah, I'm happy to be here.
So what is this event exactly?
Well, it's organized by various groups throughout the state of Iowa, and it's going to be in Storm Lake, and it'll be next Saturday, and it begins at 2:30, and it'll be on the campus of, they call it Buena Vista University. I call it Buena Vista University.
Buena Vista.
So we invited all of the candidates for president from both of the major parties, and we had two that accepted, and those are Martin O'Malley and Lincoln Chafee. The moderator of the program will be Kyle Munson, who is a columnist for the Des Moines Register, and you may recall that he had a Unite Iowa conversation with a landowner in northwest Iowa and with the director of the Des Moines Water Works a few weeks ago. So Kyle is really committed to civil dialogue. And certainly immigration is one of the areas that we have some need for civil dialogue.
On the website, you see the list of all the candidates that were invited. It's unfortunate that they don't feel the need to show up for something that is expressly designed for deeper conversation.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a sociologist. I'll put on my sociologist hat here. We worked very hard to get the Iowa Chamber Alliance to be involved in this.
What is the Iowa Chamber Alliance?
It's an alliance of the, I think, the 16 largest chambers of commerce in Iowa.
Mm-hmm.
And their director, John Steinman, last November had indicated there was an article in the Des Moines Register that they that he was working with his chambers and others to try to bring about immigration, comprehensive immigration reform. And so we started, we contacted them, and they had a person who attended one of our meetings, and we really thought that they were going to support it. But it's really interesting that not only the candidates, well, many of the candidates shy away from discussing immigration. Others, as you know, do not. We didn't get the support of those folks, and I think that might have been very helpful in getting a number of, or at least a handful of the Republican candidates there.
Mm-hmm. Do you know why the support wasn't given?
Well, I can only speculate, but it seems to me that it's one of those secondary issues mm-hmm. for the business community, and they would really like to see comprehensive immigration reform. But when it comes to their sort of the core issues of particularly of the Republican Party, and somehow, you know, my guess is that there was probably pressure for them not to support this.
Hmm. Interesting.
Yeah. So this is – you're calling this Unite Iowa on Immigration. So is it accurate to assume that you're looking to address national immigration issues but also specifically in the context of Iowa? And if so, what would you say are some of those issues in Iowa?
I would say both, yes.
Okay.
And I guess I'll take a detour for a moment to talk about the location of the forum,
right.
Which is
in Storm Lake.
In Storm Lake. Mm-hmm. And Storm Lake is a really interesting town. It is one of the meatpacking communities in Iowa that had early immigration beginning primarily in the early part of the 1990s. And
these were workers for the plant?
Yeah, primarily. And, of course, the work in the meatpacking plants is really difficult work. So most people, unless they have incredible physical capacity, can only work there 4 or 5 years. So people then began going into other areas, including running their own businesses and so forth. Mark Gray, who's an anthropologist from the University of Northern Iowa, did some studies in Storm Lake, and he was lambasted by the right. But it's really interesting how Storm Lake has progressed. And so now they have a wonderful police chief in Storm Lake who really understands about community policing and is a great spokesperson for immigration reform and for immigrants. So I think the setting is going to be really, really interesting. And I might also say something about the panelists and sort of how it's organized. The forum itself starts at 2:30 in the afternoon on next Saturday, and there'll be a group of panelists that Kyle Munson will ask questions of. So the presidential candidates will just be observing at that point. And we have the Dream Iowa founder, Monica Reyes, who is at the University of Northern Iowa. Sam Clovis is a Republican politician who has run for public office in the past. Joe Crookham, who is from Musco Lighting, which is a very progressive manufacturing firm in Iowa, and Sandra Sanchez from the American Friends Service Committee, as well as the Charles Valenti Hine, who's a senior pastor at Lakeside Presbyterian Church in Storm Lake. So we have a variety of perspectives from those folks. And then after there's this dialogue between them and Munson and with the audience, then the presidential candidates will come. And they'll be questioned by both by the audience and by the panel. So the idea is to make it an open forum in a very broad sense.
Why don't you mention again when and where it is in case somebody listening would like to go and participate?
Okay, it's going to be at Buena Vista University or Buena Vista University in Storm Lake, Iowa. It begins at 2:30. There's also a meet and greet at 1 o'clock if people would like to come to that. The doors open at 1:30. It'll last for until about 4 o'clock, I think.
Do you think this issue of denying citizenship to children of immigrants who are undocumented workers, is that going to be an issue that is going to be an important?
Well, I think it'll be important. There'll be a lot of people there that are very interested in this question. And Monica Reyes, for instance, is a dreamer who benefited from the DACA program. And it's really interesting how those people who have received temporary documentation to be here are really getting involved and organizing. So I think we're going to see a lot of push to allow the executive orders that President Obama had. I guess it was last November he instituted those, and then they were blocked by a southern judge.
This process, political process, starts out in a very thoughtful way in Iowa. Iowans tend to respond very thoughtfully to issues that candidates bring to our state, and it's really unfortunate that a lot of the candidates are not willing to show up and have this kind of really thoughtful dialogue that Iowa can provide. It sounds like an interesting event. Yeah. Iowa does have a lot of immigrants, a lot of workers, and so it is an issue relevant to our state.
Yeah.
Yeah, and we'll have a link for the event on our website so people can get more information there. Once again, it's called Unite Iowa
for
on
Immigration.
Immigration or for
and,
Immigration.
I might also add that if anyone needs a ride from here to Storm Lake, I could give my email. It's Flora J, F-L-O-R-A-J, at iastate.edu. And we have a group of people who are organizing rides there.
Okay. Great. And we'll provide that link on the website as
well.
Okay. Great. We need to wrap up.
Yeah.
We got 2 minutes.
Thanks so much for
thank you, Jan.
For coming.
Really appreciate
happy
it.
To be here. And happy birthday.
Thank you. Thank you.
You've been listening to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore people, stories, and events in Central Iowa. Thank you for joining us today. I've been your host, Gail Seiler, here with my co-host, Ursula Rudenberg.
Thanks to our in-studio guests today, Ann Kinzel and Victoria Shapinski from Ames Progressive Alliance, who told us about the Ames School Board Candidate Forum that they'll be having. That will be at the Ames Public Library on September 1st at 5:30 with an ice cream social, and there will be child care. And thanks to Jan Flora for telling us about the immigration forum that's coming up. And you've heard excerpts from talks by Nicholas Johnson, Iowa's our own former FCC commissioner and part of KHOI's birthday celebration yesterday. You will be able to hear the complete talk on Heart of Iowa on Thursday, the 27th at noon. So tune into that if you want to hear all that he had to say.
Local Talk is broadcast on KHOI at 7 a.m., noon, and 7 p.m. on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. You can also listen to today's entire Local Talk show and all of our past Local Talk shows online at our website, khoifm.org. That's khoifm.org. You'll also find links for all the people and events that were mentioned here today.
Local Talk was engineered by Jonah DeGeese. Thank you, Jonah, and have a great first day of school. Our theme song is Backtracking by Al Harris and Tom Richards from their CD, The Ballad of Kay Shelley. Other music you heard was by Kaye Sir from Grinnell, Iowa, and from South American Music.
Yeah.
Immigrants themselves.
Local Talk is a radio production training workshop as well as a radio show, which means you can be part of our team of volunteer reporters. We'll train you and you will learn and love more about our community than you ever dreamed. We do. If you would like to join the team as a reporter, contact us 292-2878 or through the website. If you enjoyed the show, tell your friends. Remember, your participation as an audience is what makes KHOI possible and meaningful. Thank you for listening and see you again on the radio.